This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right. This morning I woke up and I had my coffee pot on automatic, right? So it's made the night before, hit the button, and then, you know, I can start hearing it working about 6 o'clock this morning. And so I get up. That's my alarm. I walk out in the back deck and I walked right back inside.
Yeah.
Dude, I can't believe how quickly it became hot and humid. Like yesterday afternoon was gorgeous. And then that front moved through and then it was just disgusting instantly. It was like a light switch.
Yeah. We were, we headed up to Madison. My son did a football camp up there. And it was fun, obviously, but you know, the way up, it was raining and everything. And then the wind was picked up and then it kind of died down and then it kind of got gross. And then, like you say, this morning I went outside and the same thing. It's like, you could just drip right away.
Oh my God. And it's going to be nasty the next handful of days, you know, at this entire week, you know, to the point where I don't even know if we're going to have baseball games this week and what that looks like, or if they're going to push them back or I don't know.
Okay. So that's funny to me. I mean,
it is.
Did they cancel baseball when we played? Cause it was hot.
I'm going to tell you right now, the most miserable and shitty I have ever felt was during the week before school started, and we had two-a-day football practices, and most of them were full pads. Both times you'd have one at like 8 a.m. and then other one would be like at 4 p.m. or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's August in Iowa. The corn sweat is in full effect, just disgusting outside. And you're sitting there just like, oh, like you're so tired. You don't want to eat. You're dehydrated. You're just listening to some fat coach just like chew you down. Like, you don't know shit, Johnson, you know, like all that.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Oh my God, just miserable.
Yep.
But we never had shit canceled for heat.
No, it's crazy how that's changed. And I saw it with, especially with softball more so, is, you know, that temperature gets above about 85 degrees and they automatically, they don't have to wear the pants and they can wear shorts now to the game, you know, and it's just, I don't know. But anyways.
I don't like soccer. Okay. I'm not a fan of soccer.
Okay.
Mostly because I'm American, but anyway, I don't know what kind of, that might've been a funny joke. Maybe not to some of you, but, the World Cup was on TV. I was, you know, just kind of going through the channels and I popped it on for just a second to kind of see where they were at. Cause they were playing, one of the games were in, I think the might've been Mexico City. And I was like, all right, well, let's check, see what this out. And the announcer was like, they're giving these guys hydration breaks.
Mm-hmm.
Half like throughout the game seems cool enough to do it, you know, like, hey, let's make sure no one's injured or whatever. And the announcer was pissed. He's like, I played soccer for X number of years and this is completely unacceptable, inappropriate. And, this allows teams to rest, especially if there's any type of momentum. Yeah. And he's like, I 100% disagree with these things. And I'm just if you want to get somebody hydrated, get a substitute out.
I mean, we kind of talked about this last week, you know, with sports and how after the games, they're all worried about snacks and everything. Uh-huh. And when we were kids, you were lucky if you got an orange slice or, you know, we had that big 5-gallon, you know, Gatorade water jug that we'd carry around and everybody drink from that. And it's changed. But other than that, Saturday, our oldest daughter, she qualified for junior nationals. Which is in Des Moines the first week of August. And she won the high jump in that. So we'll be going we'll be going to in your neck of the woods, kind of first week of August there, and then so it's kind of a tapering off of sports last week with baseball and softball being done, but now it's going to be a ramp up because he starts, my son starts football to, well, it's actually, he has camp tonight starts, so it's nuts, man.
Like, my older boy doesn't want to do football, and there's a little part of me that's like, I have no problem with that. Like, mm-hmm. Is it bad to say as a parent that my kids aren't even in high school yet, and I'm almost burnt out of youth sports?
Well, it's funny you say that because so for 29 years, I've coached some level, some sport, some whatever, because my siblings were younger, and then having kids and stuff, I've just kind of evolved with it. And this year was the first year I didn't coach, you know, any basketball, baseball, or softball or anything. And I was asked to be a head coach for his football team, and I accepted it. And then like a week ago, I told him I'm not going to head coach. Yeah. And the longer, honestly, Dan, that I think about this, I don't want to coach.
Yeah.
And I just want to watch my son play if he wants to play.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of glad that I'm in. So my younger boy, I coach his baseball team, but I really just enjoy sitting back and watching. And the way club sports are these days, I even had a conversation with my preacher during Bible study where it's so crazy. And the parents are just like, hey, what about this? What about this? And the parents are so intense that I don't even want to coach anymore. I just want to train my own kids. Yeah. Like I'll just train them to be better. And that way I don't have to listen to all the extra BS that goes along with it.
That was exactly what we had this discussion about. I mean, obviously having a newborn and then five other kids, you know, I need to be at home and mm-hmm. be helping out. And I want to do that too. You know, I want to watch her grow up and stuff. But I mean, we have basically a training facility here at home. You know, we have a 40-yard indoor hay mow that's open. We turned into a sports center basically. And the kids can learn so much just hands-on, one-on-one with us.
Yeah. Yeah. Those old school basketball courts in the top of barns, dude. Yep. Like,
yeah, some of the best memories, though. Yeah. You know,
you can't shoot from the baseline, but you can you can have a full court shot across the entire barn.
Yep. Yep.
All right, deer hunting. But before we do, we got to send a shout out to two brands. Code Blue Sense, huge shout out to that company. Thanks for partnering with us over this last year, man. Really appreciate it. These guys offer a variety of real and synthetic deer urines. They offer scent elimination products. They offer, the Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kit. And, it's just, a brand, a really solid brand with really solid people. And, I'll be completely honest. The goal was to try to find a time to break away this week before state baseball to go and set up trail cameras, mineral sites, and do all that shit. But again, I'm just like, I think I'm getting pulled in too many directions, or I'm so hesitant about leaving that it's just the second I leave the house, shit's going to go wrong and I need to be here for it. Or I don't know. I'm not like, and let's talk about that. Let's sidebar that conversation for later, but huge shout out to Code Blue Sense. Go check out Code Blue Sense at, codebluesense.com, discount code HTH20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Reveal Trail Cameras. If you haven't downloaded, this is how easy it is to set up these cameras. Download the Reveal app, scan a QR code, and now instantly you have a fully functioning cellular trail camera. It is literally that simple. And they have some new products that are going to be released here in August. We got a lot of cool things coming down the pipe with that brand. So keep an eye out for the new cameras, the new technology, the updated app, and all of that stuff. So go check out tacticam.com/cameras and stay tuned for more information. All right.
The sidebar
here. And I think that should be the name of this will be the the sidebar conversation, because
like
just random conversations, I think, is where this is going to lead to.
Yep.
So I just gave, this is exactly where I'm at right now in my life, and with work and family and kids And all this stuff I used to be extremely excited for. Like, dude, I loved getting my trail cameras out in April, and I love putting the mineral out and watching all of the antlers develop and now all of this other stuff. And slowly over the last 10 years of being a dad and having kids and activities and stuff like that, I just like, is it bad for me, a position that I'm in where I get paid to talk about products and I get, you know, I'm getting paid to have this podcast and hopefully I'm being real here, but like, all some of this stuff, I just don't even like, I don't get fired up for it anymore, man.
We've talked about this a bunch, you know, with the fact that when was the last time you shot your bow?
Dude, I have it in the shop right now.
Yeah.
Like I the last time I pulled my bow back was when I shot my buck in November.
Yeah.
Straight up.
I'm going to probably top that with, I did the same thing. I shot mine November 13th. That was, you know, and then basically I took it out a few more times after that, but I moved my bow in the basement here and I'd been looking for my binoculars and rangefinder and the case and everything. And lo and behold, that's where it was. And they've all been sitting in the same spot for what, 6-7 months. And I haven't been able to find the binoculars. Well, they were in with the bow, so I haven't shot my bow either. You know what?
Yeah.
It's crazy how busy we get with kids, right?
Yeah.
But then it's also crazy how busy we get with life and work, and there comes this like peak. And I really think that the peak becomes, well, you were just talking about it with your kids going into high school and stuff. You know, there's going to come a point where they get their license and everything, and some of your responsibility kind of drifts a little bit towards them, and they have to get themselves, you know, to where they go. But I honestly, I mean, I answer your question about, you know, is it bad for you in a position that you're in? No, because you're still doing your job,
right?
You know, and whether it's promoting a product or talking about it on a daily basis, you know, but there is a shift too as you get older. And I think we can see that because being the same age and multiple guys in, you know, that have podcasts or multiple guys that, you know, do this for a living, they're all in the same boat with, man, I've shot a lot of deer, you know, I've shot some big deer and now my kids are getting older and you hear more and more about that specifically in our age.
Yeah. And then you start to like see the, for me, it all kind of ties in to the same thing. The access, the, you know, what things are changing in this world, the big bucks, you know, the habitat management, the, all these things that, you know, like where will all of this be when my boy is, or because my daughter doesn't necessarily, I think she likes turkey hunting. She likes fishing. My older boy is going to be the outdoorsman of the whole thing. But I'm just sitting here like, where's it going to be in 10 years, right? We've had, and I think about it, I have these conversations. Where is my son going to hunt in 10 years? In 10 years, the farm, one of the farms that I have access to is not going to be available anymore. It's going to get sold for a lot of money. And that means I'm out, right? I'm going to have to start leasing, traveling longer distances, things like that.
I think, you know, if somebody was just new to getting into hunting and stuff, is you really need to start putting in for out-of-state hunts and having it lined up to where each year you can have something to plan for. Because, I mean, in the last several years, we've had public land sell-off tries. We've had multiple, I don't know how I want to say it, like, because I don't want to knock one over the other, but there's mass destruction of trees and vegetation every day, every year, because of more, not just a solar field, not just a data center, not just, you know, a farmer getting wanting more ground, but that stuff is happening more and more versus the others, the flip side of that. We're not seeing, you know, new CRP fields put in. We're not seeing, you know, new forestry put in. Like that stuff is going down the downhill fast. And then on top of all of that, we have the battle in between each other with what weapon is okay to use during this season. And you know, so the list goes on and on. So 10 years from now, it's hard to say where it is, but I would definitely start looking into, because I mean, we've just seen a huge tag reduction across the board in multiple states, mm-hmm. and most states are literally becoming a draw, mandatory draw.
Right, right. Now, I've learned to take Ted Nugent with a grain of salt, okay? The guy says some crazy shit, but he's passionate, and I'll give him credit for that. But he said something the other day that I kind of liked, and he's basically just like, any youth hunter should get free license and a tags for the entire season, like not all year round, like in, you know, like July, but like as long as there's a season, we should allow kids to hunt. Mm-hmm. And they should be able to hunt as much as possible if they have, you know, come up with the rule and the regulation to regulate that. And I'm like, you know what? I like that idea. How do you get the next generation involved? You give them free stuff, right? Give them a free tag. Give them a free license. Let them go hunting. Remove the restrictions from them, for them, and let them get out and start to fall in love with it. And then, you know, you start to really think about, now right now in Iowa, there is that. However, there's the limitation is, you have to use the bow in archery season. You can't use a gun in archery season, right? But which could potentially restrict. Now, this is where I've talked a ton of shit on crossbows in mm-hmm. the past. But this is where I think the state of Iowa, and not necessarily the state of Iowa, but just like most states or whatever, this is where I feel like you give the kids an archery season, as a youth archery tag for, and you can use maybe cross, have a, not necessarily an archery tag, but a crossbow season. And if you want to, you know, give them a couple weeks within the archery season in October to go out and try to shoot a deer with a crossbow. Right. And then, you know, like if it's for the kids, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
But then the kids have to learn, like, hey, listen, crossbow's not archery. In my opinion, you're going to have to evolve to a compound bow after that. But if we're talking about getting the kids excited for the best, in my opinion, the best time of the year, and that is getting them outside in October, I mean, dude, get them outside, dude.
Well, I got a couple things that I could go off of this with. So for me, I really think that, you know, it should be fishing licenses and hunting licenses. And yeah. I think you could actually put like an age cap on it of like 16 years old, because when they're 16, they start driving, they're supposed to be responsible then. So cut it at 16 and then go from there. Yep. I also think that schools should have classes, elective classes that, you know, instead of maybe art or chorus or band or something, you could take fishing or you could take hunting and you could learn about that, or navigation classes, you know, if you wanted to get into any of that stuff, because a lot of kids aren't even introduced to it. I mean, like I wasn't introduced into hunting and I actually self-taught myself and I've enjoyed it more because of that. But if I would have had the resources to do it when I was in high school, I'd be that many more years in advance. So, I mean, if they had a navigation class, dude, I think that'd be one of the coolest things. And we'd probably do more family hiking or something.
Right. Go ahead.
Well, I just had one more thing with it. It's funny because like we were sitting at this football camp yesterday and this dad was, he threw the football to his son and the son dropped it. And the dad turns and says, maybe a few less video games, you can learn how to catch the ball, mm-hmm. you know? And yeah. I chuckled inside. But I mean, to that point, like this is a way to get the kids off the video games, like fishing, hunting, you know, hiking, whatever.
Yeah. Here's the issue. You got to have someone take them. That's the thing. Number two, you can give out all the free tags you want, but you got to have a place to go to.
Right.
Right. And so in Iowa, I mean, you got a little bit of public land, that's sprinkled around the place, but then where are they going to go, dude? Like, where are they? Oh, all these new kids are going to come hunting. Awesome. Great. Let's give them some free tags. And now where are we going to go use these tags at?
I can tell you an example here, close enough to home. So one of the local like forest preserves, they have quite a bit of money from a nuclear plant, and they own a bunch of ground. And on these properties, they basically raffle off 5-10 spots per area. And then, so 5 or 10 guys will get to go in each spot per year, and they have it for that year. And it's always a complaint. You know, like, I pay my taxes too, and I've never gotten it. This guy's gotten to hunt it 2 years in a row, and so on and so forth. So to me, it would be a lot of the same with kids getting free licenses. Well, it's not fair. Little Billy didn't get to go here because, you know, Susie's been sitting over there hunting all season long, you know, and her dad takes her, but nobody takes Billy. It just, to me, I think that's what it is. Like you said, somebody has to be able to take them, and they have to have a spot to go. Well, and you have to have a spot to go.
100%. Yeah, it's now out west, there's a lot of land that would be perfect, right? And there's other states in on the east side of the U.S. that has way more public land than what we do, and so that would be that's awesome, you know, do that. And I think, like, I really do think that I don't know, it just keeps going back to antlers for me for some reason. It's like antlers. Oh God, gotta have big antlers. I got it. Mm-hmm. Like, people are hoarding land, but at the same time, do whatever you want on your property. If you have money to spend on property, I believe you should be able to do that and love that. So it just I don't even know what is the greater good for the hunting community, like, and for the what hunting looks like in another 20 years. Like, what is the greater good?
I don't know, because I obviously, when I sit and mow, I listen to podcasts in and out, you know, and I hear so much different stuff, and I don't always remember where it comes from. But I was listening to one that, you know, a guy can, if he has money, right? Mm-hmm. If he has resources, he can go buy land, he can, you know, develop his land, and theoretically he can grow his own deer, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it curves his hunting to some degree, you know, because I mean, you can train deer, right? And you can build fences. And, you know, if those fences are tall enough, you can kind of keep them on your property. And there's a lot of things that I thought with that. And it kind of ruins, it gives it a bad connotation, but it's also, maybe that's what they enjoy, you know? Yeah. So it's just like, you know, shoot your buck or shoot, you know, what makes you happy. Hunt the way you want to hunt to make you happy, as long as it's legal.
Yeah. Yeah, it sucks, because I am so for the do what makes you happy thing, and that's on both sides of the spectrum. You know, whether you're the landowner who wants to manage, or you're the public land guy who hunts one day a year type of deal, go out and do whatever makes you happy. But where does the greater good lie for the future of hunting, to where it doesn't become this continued pay to play type thing? So I don't know.
I think the only thing we can do is something we talked about a few weeks ago, and it's literally just sticking together with it instead of letting something come in between us, whether it's a crossbow topic or whether it's this Michigan topic, you know, I think as long as we stay together, you're on a straighter path. But that also doesn't mean that the government's not going to come in and try to sell off land. It doesn't mean that they're not going to reduce tags, and there's a lot of things that are out of a lot of things out of our control.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. All right, guys, you know me, and I love eating wild game, but I don't eat wild game every single night. Every once in a while, I'll reach for a side of beef, and that's why I trust Omaha Steaks. Because Omaha Steaks are sent directly to my door, I can keep my freezer stocked without having to go to the grocery store. It's honestly like having a trusted butcher and gourmet food shop right at your house. Last week, I pulled out their pure ground ribeye burgers for a quick grill session. The flavor and marbling was unreal, rich, juicy, and miles ahead of any average grocery store meat. Try the Burger Perfection Flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com, promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan & Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan & Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
We've been talking about that a lot. Mm-hmm. All right. We got to shelf that because we talk about it probably too much. But it only because it's important to us.
Yeah.
But now we're getting closer to, like, I saw a buck from the road the other day. And he was like 400 yards out in this bean field, and I could see that he was a buck, meaning the bone is growing, my friends. Yep. And we got this hot weather coming in. Let's talk a little strategy right now. Okay. Hot weather strategy for, I don't know, early season, just hot weather in general. What have you noticed about what hot weather, or let's just go extreme temperatures or extreme weather, like tons of snow or tons of cold or tons of ice or tons of rain, things like that.
Yeah. I mean, to me, what I see is like deer, they select windows, right? You know, so they can feel a front, they can see a front. If it's a warm front, you know, those deer, to me, they're going to feed equally before that hot comes in, just as much as after, you know. So if your peak time of temperature for the day is between 3 and 7 p.m. or something, I wouldn't be surprised to see a deer out before that feeding. Mm-hmm. And then bedded up in the shade in a valley or something next to water while that's, you know, taking place. And same would go for like a rain, you know, a rain event. They're going to be in shelter and stuff, but then they're going to be feeding before and after. I saw the same thing you saw. I saw a buck out in a bean field, and it was kind of odd, but there was like a cool front, not a cold front, but a cool front that had come through, and he was out in this field by himself. And they're starting to put on some inches. So,
yeah, I saw a buck. This was last year. It was a whole bunch of deer. And so we have a golf cart in our town, and we drive around this, we call it the loop, right? And it goes out into the country a little bit, and you can see into fields. And we counted like 20 deer out at like 3 p.m. But then I kind of went back and looked at, why are these deer out?
Yeah.
And it was an hour or two before the peak of the day's heat hit.
Yep.
And so they had been sitting all morning, and I don't understand why they wouldn't have stood up and ate and drank in the morning. But then I drove back around the time where this peak heat was hitting, and they were all gone.
Yep.
So something in them told them to get up early to eat and then to get back down. Now, the question that I have is, have you seen this in October? Because I haven't seen it in October, and maybe they were feeding because it's July, and, or when I saw this, it was like July where there's a ton of green versus October when I'm hunting on a hot day, and they didn't get up and necessarily feed any earlier. So was that food source related or heat related?
Well, I would throw a couple questions back, and I would say, are you driving around in October paying attention to that equally as much as you're actually sitting in the stand? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, like on the drive to the farm, the farms, I'm sitting and observing what I see in the timber on the fields and things like that.
So I guess my other thing would be, in October, you've already seen a bunch of crops come out. So like there's already there's already bare ground. You have less vegetation, and deer are probably going to be using that corn or edges more so than going out in a standing bean field to eat. It would be my thoughts.
Yeah. And more on a stricter bed to food pattern potentially as well. Yeah. Could be. Could be less green.
Less daylight.
Yeah. Yep. Less green, less daylight. I don't know. All I know is that you drive. I want to know about why deer are on their feet at certain times. And so I go and I look at the barometer and I look at, and you know, it's one of those things where it's just like, it's hot as balls out. It's 1:30 in the afternoon. Why are the deer on their feet right now? Right? They didn't all get bumped out of their beds. Something is telling them to stand up and feed right now. Right. And it's consistent around this loop that we take. And some of these deer are over a mile away from each other. So I'm trying to, you know, like as the same thing as where, you know, one of the biggest bucks, most mature bucks I've ever encountered, would have been November 4th, 2017 or something like that. It might've even been my birthday. And I was hunting this buck called Megatron, and he was this gigantic 8-pointer. He ended up getting killed on the neighboring property during the muzzleloader season. Anyway, gigantic 8-pointer, solid white antlers, just like you could see him coming through the timber. It was gnarly, huge buck. I documented him for a couple years. Anyway, dude, we set up in this tree. And we were soaked, and I mean just soaking wet with sweat. It was like 85 degrees outside in November. And now I just said November. What does November mean? Breeding, right? So you add that aspect into it. Deer are obviously going to be on their feet a little bit more throughout the course of the day because of the breeding season. However, it's hot. And this buck shows up. Like at 3:34. I just got up in the stands. He shows up 3:34 o'clock and we're just dripping and he shows up. Why did that buck show up when it was so hot? When everything we've ever learned about deer hunting has told us, well, you know, when I was years ago, people would be like, dude, I don't even hunt when it's that hot because the likelihood of me running into a deer are very low. Well, guess what? I have the opposite experience. There's an experience that goes against that right there.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I don't know. I think going back to the summer, they're going to feed sporadically and they're going to pick those windows, you know? Yeah. And I think when beans are green, they love green beans. You know what I mean? And then we see that shift when beans start to change the color and everything. So, I mean, I don't think we're going to see them as much early, like October-ish in those bean fields, you know? Yeah. So I don't think temperature is going to allow that, but that doesn't mean that they're maybe not in cornrows where we can't see them. Yeah. Or, you know, eating some other vegetation. So, I mean, they may still be feeding. It just may be a different food source at that point.
Right.
So I don't know. Cause I've watched it like, you know, with certain particular deer, like I monitored one for like 5 years that I was after and I had him pinpointed, you know, and I did the same thing. Like you're saying, like, I'd look at barometer, I'd look at wind direction, temperature, you know, rain. I even threw in the moon and I had the moon as like, you know, guys that talk about hunt in and around the full moon and whether it's rising or setting. I had that all dialed in on this deer and I elected to not sit that spot, of course, but I did end up shooting a nice buck that night, but it wasn't from lack of information or lack of trying. Like all the pieces were there, you know? So, I mean, to me, I probably should, if I was going to do it now, I would probably monitor a doe group that had, you know, 5 to 10 does in it. And that's what I would be concentrating on. Like, why are you feeding at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? Because to me, a buck, by the time he gets to October, he's starting to get a little, you know, feisty. He might get up in the middle of the day anyways. You know, he might get up in the middle of the afternoon, but I would be more inclined to know what the doe group is doing and why they're feeding at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in October versus the buck at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in October.
Right. And that is where I have become so frustrated over the years, where I'll get a big buck on trail camera this time of year and you're going, dude, he's going to be a giant. and then he disappears in September, yep. and you don't ever see him, right? And then he comes back the next year, and you're like, oh my God, he's going to stick around this year. Gone, right? Yeah. Summer pattern, fall pattern, whatever, moves. And that's where, like, I want to hunt these animals, but these animals aren't, they're not playing, they're not like, I can't go, I hope this buck sticks around. And then that buck listens to me and goes, Dan really wants me to stick around this year. So I think I'm going to stick around this year. That's not how it works, right? So that's where I've gotten frustrated over the years. And I love like looking at the deer and putting the trail cameras up and things like that. But come the hunting season, none of it matters.
No.
Right? It's all for, it's all like just extra at that point.
Well, I mean, we could say with the trail cameras, right? Our trail camera strategies may be different. They may be the same, but, you know, I'll use mine to get inventory of bucks that are in the area, correct? Yeah. But I'm also using them, especially closer to season. Mm. I want to see what does are frequent, you know, and you can pinpoint that too, by markings on them or by how many fawns they got with them, or if it's a specific time in the morning or night that they're coming through. And I'm going to monitor those does instead of that buck. I mean, I'm stacking the odds by hunting the doe group instead of hunting one particular buck.
Yeah. And that's what I mean is that has what has led me to my infatuation with doe groups instead of particular bucks, because I know that I could get really fired up about a buck in August and September, but that doesn't mean he's going to be there in October. Guess who, in my opinion, is always there? The doe groups are always there. They're always there. And I don't know why. And this is where I would love to talk with a wildlife biologist or somebody who's done the research. Why do doe groups sit to tighter core areas and more of a stricter bed to food pattern all year round? A buck could be in one spot all year round, you know, whatever. And the food sources change, but the doe groups also have the same food sources change, but they don't change their pattern as opposed to the buck's pattern being changed.
All right. I'm going to just correlate it to humans as best as I can in my thoughts. And I'm going to say that a wife is probably a better homemaker than a dad.
Okay.
And I'm just generally speaking. Okay.
Yep.
She is going to make sure that all the kids have what they need. It's in these spots and whatever. And not saying that guys don't, because trust me, I know how this works too. And, but there also becomes that sex drive thing, you know, and guys almost need that, right? And that's where buck will like, it's good at home, but like, you know, here I go. And I'm not saying that guy's like cheating or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying.
Where are you going with this?
I'm just saying, like, a woman, you know, will make a better home than what a guy would. And once they're comfortable in that home, you know, because the whole theory of, like, you know, a house isn't a home, it's the people that are in it that make it a home. Right. Well, the buck doesn't have to care for the fawns, right? So to me, if the doe is making it a home, she's got it comfortable for them. It's a home for them. They have what they need, food, water, shelter, and they're good to go. And a buck, he's living off of two things. It's food and survival, basically, and sex.
Yeah. Yeah. The breeding season is a gigantic indicator. And I'm guessing, now, I've never necessarily seen it other than capturing some stills on trail camera. Once that velvet comes off in September, then you see everything start to shake up, right? That September shift, we talked about it before. But that's where you start to see like the ears back in the pictures, right? Two deer, in a field and their ears are back, that means they're posturing. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of the territory and how it's broken up and what deer stays and what deer goes depends on what doe groups are in the area and the cover available, but also like who the big dog is, right? A big dog could say, I'm comfortable in a safe spot down in this little nook and cranny all year. Now it's time, the testosterone level is peaking. I'm going to go develop my area and or my zone, my core area that I'm going to live in, and I'm going to have my rut in. And I really do think that there's more fighting and dominance being established in September than any other month. There potentially is even more fighting that takes place in September by, let's just say, two mature bucks. But a big mature buck doesn't need to go in to, and fight a two-year-old, right? He just puts his ears back. He maybe snort wheezes. He postures. And that two-year-old goes, I am not messing with that guy.
And he just walks off.
He leaves, right? Yeah. He doesn't want to fight that buck.
So I guess, I mean, kind of to that point, like what you're saying, at least what I get out of it is a doe fawn is probably more apt to stay where she was born than a buck fawn.
Yeah.
Unless dominance.
Yeah. Unless there's dominance. However, I've seen doe groups fight each other. Two doe groups meet. And two does come to the same little clover patch in this grass field, and then they stand up and they do the slapping that they do.
Yeah.
I've seen that as well. And so, excuse me. But the bucks, they get kicked out and they have to go find a new territory. And then that's where, but the whole point of this conversation is how do you hunt those bucks when you may catch them all year, and then how do you try to, and then they disappear, and maybe you have historic data of them coming back into the farm every once in a while? Because I'll be okay, so let me just back up a second. I have a, I'm assuming, 6-year-old buck this year. Last year he would have been high 160s, maybe low 170s, right? His brow tines aren't that spectacular. However, I have proof that he shed his antlers and his antlers have been found. Now, he doesn't come into the farm all the time. He lives on, I'm guessing his core area is the outskirts of his core area are the farm that I hunt. Knowing that, I know, like, I have trail cameras out, and I know where he has been picked up on trail cameras for the last 3 years now. Okay. It's either on this little fence crossing that is a border to another property, or it's a rope-a-dope mock scrape kit that I've set out, right? Those are the two places that I have caught this buck. Now you go down 100 yards, or like not 100, I would say maybe 400 yards, and there's another trail camera down there. He has not, in a big pinch point, he has not been picked up on that once. Does that mean he goes through it? No, it doesn't mean anything really. But according to the data that I have him two spots, and those two spots are probably 100 yards apart. Mm-hmm. Now, what do I do? If I want to run into this buck and try to go after the biggest antler deer possible on this farm this year, let's just hypothetically say he grows, we're talking a Boone and Crockett caliber whitetail. But I also know that he is not going to show up every day, that he is not a homebody buck based off of the last couple years of trail camera data. So I have to do one of two things. I have to wait him out and go and have the best possible access routes for multiple wind directions that get me into this little doe bedding area. And I have to be willing to sit all day or multiple days in a row, passing other bucks that come in and out, waiting for that one particular deer to come through, if that is the buck that I want to go after, right?
So that kind of takes me to the question I was thinking while you're talking about it, is it kind of depends on what your style of hunting is for that deer. Are you hunting bedding, food, or travel?
Yeah. Basically what I'm doing is I have a tree stand in there right now that I set up during shed season, right? And there's another tree stand. I want to say like close, right at 100 yards away. So it's this bedding area. And I have one for a south wind and I have one for a north wind in there. Okay. And so north, northwest, I could probably even get away with a west, northwest wind, definitely not a west, but I have two stands in these locations to where I can get a, like I have options basically, south winds versus north winds. And so I just have to bide my time, get in there and know when to get in. You know, am I going to go in the mornings? I have limited access. Am I going to come out if the wind shifts? How do I do this without disturbing this doe bedding area? Because once the does are disturbed, then their bucks won't come in unless they're blindly checking bedding, right?
Right. So if you had to rank it priority wise, how would you rank it? Doe bedding, doe travel, or a feeding area?
Well, for the rut, all the food is on the neighboring farm. Uh-huh. Not all of it, but you know, they're going to destination food, on other properties. Great. Right. That's great. I have the bedding. So my priority, because of the scenario that I'm given, is doe bedding, right? I have doe bedding, but it's hard to hunt a bedding area in an afternoon hunt.
Yeah.
Right. My access goes right in, and maybe I could find a way to sneak in through the creek bed or finding a way, but at some point I got to pop out of the creek bed and walk up a bank that, and then climb up into a tree where these deer could just literally watch me, uh-huh. right? Do it. So I have to be prepared for potentially some all day sits to see, like, I don't know, like I'm going to have to put in some time if I want that particular buck.
Have you seen, so just say a farm lays out to where predominantly most of the doe trails and travel mm-hmm. areas go north and south. Just say it's that way. Mm-hmm. Have you seen a buck travel east to west to cover as much ground as he can and like cross over those to see if he can check a doe and that if she's hot?
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I'll say is I've seen bucks travel through, man, the term thermal hub, mm-hmm. right? Where everything gets sucked down, multiple drainages touch one point. That's where the biggest scrapes I've ever seen have been. I've seen deer during the rut travel in ways that put them downwind of bedding. So they're using their nose to do that. I don't necessarily know if they're traveling perpendicular or parallel to doe movement. All I know is that it's heavily influenced by the doe bedding areas and yeah. where they will come in. And then what happens is they find that doe bedding area and they'll catch some scent and then they'll dive into it. And they almost are trying, the younger bucks do this. It's almost like they're trying to make a lot of noise and kick the does up to see who's in there or if there is even any deer in there, nose down to the ground, like almost like a bird dog looking for yeah. a bird. Yeah. And then they'll kick something out. And once they kick something up, they'll stop, they'll look at it, and then they'll start chasing.
Yep.
That would be like peak breeding.
Yeah.
But like for me, my strategy is not to go into some chaotic mess where, let's say that big buck comes into this doe bedding area. Dude, I don't think big bucks operate in the rut like spastic 3-year-olds do.
No.
Right? The 4-year-olds, 5-year-olds, they will observe. They'll stop and pause. They'll use their nose heavily. And then what they'll do is the best example that I've ever seen of this is in 2000 and... was it? It would have been 2009. Okay. 2008 or 2009. I think it was 2009. I'm hunting a buck called Shipwreck. And it was late October. Perfect. Like perfect night. I mean, crisp, cool wind access, money, money, money. And I was hunting a doe group at this point. This doe group would come out of this really thick neighboring property and walk up a finger and cross a road at dark to go to a destination ag field. Well, maybe it was even early November. Anyway, it was like pre-rut type of environment. And these four does or handful of does came out and they walked by me 20 yards broadside. And I'm just like, dude, this is happening. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
And guess who shows up? My 185-inch target buck. And he walks up to where the thickness stops, where the does had dropped down this little, small little bowl, and they walk right by me. And what does this buck do instead of go after him? The wind is in his favor with these does. He puts his nose in the air, and he understands those does are not ready to breed right now. So what does he do? He goes, kind of loops around, and he goes back searching for different does. Yeah. Like, he didn't need to go chase those does, because if those does were ready, all he has to do is show up and breed.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
He's top dog.
Yeah.
Right? He's at the point, at that time, I think it was like an eight-year-old. Eight-year-old, 180-inch, giant whitetail body was, you know, he looked like a Holstein. And so that buck shows up. He doesn't fight. He flexes. Does see that. And maybe he just has to do a little bit of chasing, but the does want to breed him equally as he wants to breed the does. Yeah. And so he showed up, he scent checked, and he took a right turn and walked out of my life.
Yep. Well, I got a very similar story, but mine's got decoys involved. And it's pretty cool because it took me several years to figure out, like, you know, once you know the does on your farm, you kind of know when they cycle every year. So I thought I had this farm figured out, and I hadn't had any luck. And it came down to the middle of November, and it was like right before, it was like 4 days before gun season in Illinois here. And I had a buck and a doe decoy out in front of me at about 12, 15 yards, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And out pops this doe across the field, and she's getting chased by a couple young bucks. And then they're running her all, I mean, just running her ragged for a half hour probably. And I ended up seeing four bucks there, and then out walks this four-year-old. And so all this commotion still going on north of me. They're like at a point, and this four-year-old, he could care less what these deer are doing. You know, he sees the two that are in front of me that are calm, cool, and collective, and all he does is pins his ears back and walks into that buck decoy, because he knows that doe's not running. She's not running hard. He could breed her, and he's obviously the dominant buck of the group. I shot that deer, you know, right outside of that decoy range there, and he stopped, and he pinned his ears back, and he started to come towards that buck like he was going to fight him, and he's got a hole right through his heart at that point, and he went over the hill and died. Like, I mean, he came in with still all that adrenaline to fight that buck, to breed that doe and everything, could care less about all that commotion going on with those younger bucks, because he knew that doe wasn't ready to breed yet.
Right. And and the opposite is true, where if there is a doe ready to breed, they are 100% focused on that.
Absolutely.
Calling will not work on that. Do you know, I've been hunting now for, I don't even know, over 20. So 2006, it was a tipping point for me. 2006 is when I started becoming hardcore about bow hunting. I hunted before that, you know, since I've been like 12 or something, but I never took it serious, right? So 2026 marks my 20th year of very serious bow hunting, right? I've been hunting for 30 plus years. Anyway, 2026 is, and in that time frame where I've started taking these things very seriously, I have only pulled one buck off of a doe where the buck was dogging her, and I rattled, and he came in to investigate. So that tells me maybe that doe wasn't as hot as I thought she was, right? And the buck wasn't as old or mature as I thought he was. Because of that. But ever since then, dude, I've snort wheezed, I've called, grunted, rattled at all these deer throughout that time frame. And when they're locked in, and you're not pulling them off these does. So that's just another example of me wanting to get close to doe groups.
No, and I think the one piece of advice I'd give with it is if you do happen to get that attention of that buck and he starts to come in, he's probably not coming in all the way because he's going to stay as close as he can to that doe that he knows he can get back to her. He's going to come in far enough to get downwind of you or to see you or to hear you or something. But I did it to he was probably a five-year-old a few years ago. He was chasing a young doe through the woods and everything, and I saw him, and I got him. I got him to come into about 60 yards. And then this is just, I mean, proof that these deer, they will pinpoint you where you're at. I literally tried to turn in that tree and just softly grunt so he would come down the hill, cross the fence and all the things and get within about 20, 30 yards. That deer blew out of there so fast, laughing at me like, why are you calling at me at 60 yards? You know, you fool. Yeah. So, I mean, and he didn't leave that doe very far. That doe was probably 50 yards from him, you know, when he came off of her trail down to me. But there's so many lessons that you can learn with it. And it's funny because like what you're saying is a big mature buck is not going to go get in the commotion if he doesn't have to. And like, he knows he can step out in the field and a lot of deer are just going to run away from him anyways.
Oh, dude, one of the coolest things I've ever seen happen like 3 years ago. And it might have been even in the late season. It was late season. And so it was late December, maybe early January. And I was late season hunting. And I watched a 150-inch buck, 4-year-old, walk out into this bean field that the neighbor guy had left out. And so I was hunting a transition between bedding and this neighbor's food. And so all these deer started funneling out of the property that I had access to. 150-inch deer steps out and I'm just like, bingo, like it's game time. And what happens? This like 5 or 6-year-old 120-inch 8-pointer steps out. And he was gigantic, gigantic bodied. He came into that bean field, ears back, and he beat the shit out of that 150-inch 4-year-old and chased him off. And now that food plot belonged to him.
Yep.
Right? Yep. And all the other deer stayed away from him, does included. Right? He went in there, this is mine, stay away from me. And so that's just a little bit of, I don't know, that I think this dominant thing kind of happens all year round. The breeding season obviously amplifies it, but when you look at a bachelor group of velvet bucks, right, there's times in trail camera pictures where you'll see just the ears go back and then you see that particular buck on that mineral site for the next 5-10 minutes. He's got what he wants out, and then everybody else gets in line past him, you know, like the same things. You know what else is really crazy that I've observed over the years is a big mature buck will be at a mineral site. Mm-hmm. A doe will come in and kick him. A mature doe will come in and kick him off of it.
Hmm.
And it's almost like these mature does are truly like, I don't know, like, I know bucks and does in the summertime probably live two completely different lives. They're not bedding together. They're not a herd animal like, you know, like cows would be. But I've seen it to where a doe will come in and she is now in charge. And she will kick big 4 or 5-year-old bucks off mineral sites. And now that belongs to her type of deal.
Have you noticed how like a bachelor group of bucks it'll start out 5, 6, or 7 deer in it, bucks in it. And then closer to season, it'll be like a big dominant buck. And then a little, you know, forky will be with him, and he'll always send that little forky out before him. You know, he'll always come out, and then you get closer to that breeding season and that forky's gone. Like he got too excited too soon. The big dog knew when he could go in. And so like it literally goes from like, it's a backwards pyramid, you know, down to that one dominant buck, and he can literally shift everything right out of there if he wants.
Yeah. Or the opposite is true, right? Where I've noticed this in September is I got all these great deer on my property, and then now they start to disappear. And then one mature buck takes their place.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They all kind of jostling for position over a particular doe group. And the fighting really happens when those very small areas overlap.
Yeah. And yeah, antler size literally has nothing to do with it. I've watched some of the biggest bucks, biggest antler deer shift right out of there. And then I have one, you know, basket rack eight that just happened to be like a 280 pound deer that wanted to shove everybody around. So I don't know. It's pretty cool when you think about it, but back to the original question, why they're up at, you know, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I mean, you know, I don't know, man. I mean, like I get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I'll eat, you know? So I mean,
I don't,
dude, if I'm hungry, I'm hungry.
Yeah. Yep. I'll sleep. I usually sleep all night. Last night I didn't.
Oh, well, you don't have a newborn either.
No, I don't. Last night I had, I did too much. My wife made enchiladas and my wife's enchiladas are money. Like, oh my God. She made them so good last night. And so I had a second helping of them. So I had my regular amount and then I went back for seconds and then I must have snored all night because I kept waking up with dry mouth and having to like roll over and drink some water. And then I had to stand up and take a piss and all that stuff. So
speaking to like enchiladas and stuff, like are you into hot, spicy food?
No, I'm not.
So you never have been?
No, I've never been. Oh, okay. I'll tell you what, my limit goes to Cholula, where I will put that on some eggs. But like really spicy stuff that knocks your ass, dude, I can't handle that stuff at all.
Man, I used to be able to just go out to the garden, eat a ghost peppers, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I love spicy food. We went to eat last night in Madison and we stopped at Dave's Hot Chicken or something like that. And I'm like, I'll get the hot stuff, you know, and like, dude, I get into that second sandwich and I can't. I got to put it down. My face is red. I'm sweating. I'm crying. Kids are laughing at me like, you know, you sissy, you're not going to eat it, you know. And I don't know what happened other than age.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I heard this rumor that your taste buds change every 7 years to the point where you start to like different foods. So I don't know. I'm waiting for that change to where that allows me to like you know, like spicy stuff. But
so if ours changed every 7 years, does a deer change every year taste buds, and does that change his food source? And then I'll leave you with that question and we can call her quits.
Well, that's a great question, but from a food plot standpoint, everything that I've read or have heard is, for example, brassicas are a perfect example,
right?
Radishes, turnips, it takes them, if it's introduced as a food plot, it takes them multiple years to get to the point where they adapt to eating that.
Yep.
So that maybe if you're a short-term food plot guy and you're looking to plant a food plot, maybe turnips and brassicas are not the best thing to plant unless you have a long-term strategy in mind, because it takes them a handful of years to get used to that. Outside of that, you know, the clovers, the stuff that grows naturally throughout the, you know, the countryside or is in fence rows or pastures and things like that, they're probably sticking to more of what they like every year and what they're used to as going out and exploring. Now, I will say this. I think a white-tailed deer has been documented and known to eat 250 different varieties of vegetation.
Yeah. Okay.
A mule deer can eat 450 different varieties of, because they need it or something like that. Also, kind of going back to this conversation about heat.
Yeah.
The amount of water that some of these animals get throughout the year, throughout the hot spells, are in the food that they eat as well.
Not water source.
Not necessarily water sources. So you hear these guys go, oh, you need to hunt water source in hot weather. Well, I've spent some time in some river bottoms and I've seen deer in the hottest temperatures cross right across a creek without dropping their head for a drink. And so I'm just like, when are you getting your water? you must be doing it at night or something like that, or you're eating enough vegetation throughout where it's keeping you hydrated.
I think it's more like, you know, they're on a feeding pattern just as much with food as they are for the water. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I think where a water source comes into play is like peak rut. It gets warm out. The bucks have been chasing. They're all thirsty and parched then. They've used and expended more energy than they normally would. So that's, to me, where I would hunt a water source.
Yeah, for during the rut, you think,
yeah.
when
yeah,
they're
I
expending
think so.
Additional energy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so, because, I mean, otherwise, I think they're on a, you know, off the bed to food pattern, and in that food cycle, there's a water source that they can dip down to or whatever. If we get into extremely dry temperatures or dry weather, maybe water becomes more of a factor, but they know where the water's at, too. I watched elk do it last year in Colorado.
Like, yeah, I went to Nebraska.
Yeah.
And in 90 degrees days, I'm sitting on this hill just drenched, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I hate my life at this point. And I'm watching whitetails come out of these cracks and walk right by cattle tanks.
Yep.
And I'm like, wait a second. Like, where are they getting? And maybe they're visiting the cattle tanks after dark where I can't see them. But I would think if you're baking all day long, your first thing you're going to do is go and try to drink, but that wasn't the case. So, dude, I don't know. Every year, I think I know the moral of this whole conversation is every year I think I know something and I don't know shit, really.
We'll go back to the title and we'll just sidebar it till next time.
Sidebar it till next time. Absolutely. Jason, man, really appreciate your time as always. If you guys like the How to Hunt Deer podcast, do me a huge favor. Go to Spotify, go to Apple Podcasts, wherever you download or listen, give us a 5-star review. Also, make sure you're following along on YouTube and Instagram. There's a lot of sidebar conversations on there as well. Good vibes, everybody. Stay cool, and we'll talk to you next time.